Today we're looking at a story of a young man who is filled with anger and jealousy, resentment, feelings of betrayal, and all of this is topped off with a generous sprinkling of self-righteousness. We find the story of this young man on the backside of what we call the parable of the prodigal son. And when we read the parable of the prodigal son, we usually just stop, mentally anyway, with the first son. He's the important one here. But really, there's as much story in the second half as there is in the first, and as much to be learned, because the parable is to be taken as a whole. Now, the parable begins with a very simple statement. A man had two sons. And the younger son went to his father one day and said, "Father, I want my inheritance." And by doing so, he's saying to his father, "I consider you dead to me. I want my money now." And for some reason, the father agrees and divides his assets between the younger son and the older son. And he gives them each what is coming to them. The older son, of course, would receive more than the younger son. But the younger son takes his money and gathers up all his possessions and leaves town. He goes to a place that's far away, that's different, where the customs are strange. I think it was Arkansas. And there, he lives a wild life, squandering all of his money until he's got nothing left. And there's a famine in the country, so the economy collapses, and he's got no hope of making any money at all until finally he finds a job with somebody, a farmer who says, "I want you to go out in the fields and take care of the pigs." He does. He's out feeding the pigs. He's literally starving to death, and he would have eaten the pig food, but nobody offered him anything. So here he was, the son of a wealthy landowner who's lost all of his money, has nobody around feeding pigs. And he realizes that he'd be better off working on his father's farm, because at least there the hired hands had enough food with extra left over. So he makes up this plan to go home. So he apologizes to his father, asks if he'll just let him work on the farm. And he heads back. And the father sees him coming. Apparently the father had been watching for him. And the father runs out and greets him. And the father's not angry. Instead, he embraces him, kisses him, brings him back, has him dressed up in fine clothes and shoes, puts the family ring on his finger, and orders that the fatted calf be slaughtered, and they celebrate. Because the son that was dead is now alive. That's a great story there. A story that tells us, that in which Jesus used the parable to teach us of God's infinite love. But it keeps going, because we learn about the other son, the older brother, the one who didn't ask for his inheritance, the one who stayed behind and worked for his dad. And as we read today, that elder son, he was working out in the fields, and at the end of the day, he's headed home, and as he approaches the house, he hears something. Music, dancing, shouting, laughter. Something's going on, and he didn't get the memo about this. So he asked one of the servants, "What's going on? Why all the noise? What's the ruckus?" And the servant says, "Your brother has come. Your father's killed the fatted calf because your brother is safe and sound." And the older son decided that he wasn't going into this party. He was angry, and he refused to go in. So he's standing out there sulking, probably as his arms cross, and he's stomping his feet occasionally just to make his point, when his father comes out, begs, pleads for him to come inside. But the older son, he's got something to say to dad. He says, "Listen!" Doesn't address him politely. "Father, I have something I want to say." No, he yells, "Listen!" And then all this anger comes out, and he says, "For all these years, I've worked like a slave for you. I've done everything you said. I've never disobeyed a command. And what did I get in return? Did I even get a goat that I might have a barbecue with my friends? No. But this son of yours," I love, "this son of yours, He comes back. He's devoured all of your assets in loose living, and you kill the fatted calf for him. Yeah, he's angry. Feels betrayed. Resentful of his brother. I mean, after all, he has been the one, he's been the good son that stayed behind. But you read this little tirade, and you begin to wonder, how true is it? I mean, is he just being a little overly dramatic here? Yes, he did not leave. And yes, he has continued to work on his father's property. But did he work like a slave? I doubt it. And did he not receive anything from his father? Well, he's got a job, he's got a house, he's got a place, he's got food. Sounds like he's probably done pretty well working for dad. I don't know why he didn't get a young goat. Maybe he never asked for it. I'm sure if he had asked, he would have gotten it. But he's very angry at the son who went away and seems to have gotten away with it, has now come back and is received into the family with no consequences. But the father answers him, and he tells the son, "Son, you're here. You're always with me. And anything that I have is yours. But your brother came back, and we simply had to celebrate. He was dead. He's come to life. He was lost and has been found." Now, Jesus tells this parable, along with the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin, in a context. You'll recall that the chapter begins with these words. "Now, the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to Jesus to listen to him." Tax collectors and sinners, those who are on the fringes of polite society, those who no longer, for whatever reason, feel welcome worshiping in the synagogues and the temples and being part of the community. Whatever they've done, they don't feel welcome there. And yet, here is Jesus opening his arms to these tax collectors and sinners and saying, "Come, sit here with me. I will speak, I will teach, I will tell you of God's love." And they feel welcomed. But there's a group that's not happy about this. The Pharisees. Pharisees, as I said, they're not evil people. They have simply committed their lives to obeying God's commands, at least how they interpret them. Everything they do is designed to obey God's will. And so they have literally hundreds of laws and rules and statutes and practices that they believe will keep them in a right relationship with God. But then they look over at Jesus, who's consorting with these sinners and these tax collectors. And Jesus, a man of God, is opening his heart to them, and they're a little jealous, the Pharisees. They're a little resentful. They're a little angry. All the work that they've put into this relationship with God seems kind of pointless because Jesus is saying, "Come, come, be with me, be with God." So Jesus tells these parables. Parable of the lost sheep, lost coin, and the lost sons. And what do you think the Pharisees thought when they heard this last parable? They probably heard the part about this lost, the older son, and they go, yeah, we get it. He's right. He has been treated badly. He should get more than that younger son because he's been good. He's stood faithfully next to God, done everything that God has asked. This parable, all three of these parables, through them, Jesus is teaching us about God's infinite, unending love. And of all the characters in the story, the one who probably understands this more than anybody, ironically, is the older brother. He's a witness to the Father's infinite love. He doesn't like it. but he sees it. He's the one who's been faithful. He's the one who didn't run away. He followed all that his father asked, and he doesn't like it that his ne'er-do-well brat of a little brother can skip town, squander his wealth, and then come back and be accepted as if nothing had ever happened. Or even worse, be accepted and receive a party, to be applauded for what he's done. I mean, after all, what kind of father would act this way? I mean, a good father would let the younger son know that he's done wrong, maybe let him work to earn his lesson, learn his lesson. But he doesn't. Just welcomes him back with infinite love. The older son is working from a scarcity mentality because for him, his father's love is finite. It's limited. The older brother's living in a zero-sum game where if the younger brother gets more, then he gets less. That the love comes out of one barrel, and if it goes over here, there's less for this person over here. And I'm sure the Pharisees would agree as they hear this, because those sinners that Jesus is consorting with, they are taking God's love from them. Those sinners are taking Pharisees' love. Love that they believe that they have rightly earned and deserve. Gospel of Matthew offers us another parable, a great one, the parable of the vineyard workers. And in this parable, we are told that a man owns a vineyard, and he goes out early in the morning, and he hires workers to go out and work the vineyard, and he promises them a full day's wage, the going rate, a good, fair wage. But then during the day, the owner of the vineyard goes out and hires more workers and sends them out into the vineyard. They don't discuss pay. He just sends them out. Right up until the last minute, he's sending people out to work. And then at the end of the day, he has all the people come back. And he tells his foreman to pay those who had gone out last first. And they're paid for a full day. The others are watching this, especially those who went out in the morning. And they're going, wow, if those who worked an hour got a full day's pay, then we're going to get a lot more, aren't we? But as they pay all the workers, they're all paid exactly the same. One full day. And those who went out first are very upset about this because they feel they should be paid more. And the owner explains to them, I am paying you what we agreed to. It's my choice to pay these others. And the parable ends with the question, are you envious because I am generous? Is the older brother envious because his father has been generous? Now, maybe the most shocking thing about our story, the parable, is the ending, because it's open-ended. The parable simply ends with the father stating to the son, to his older son, son, you are always with me and all that is mine is yours, but we had to celebrate. But the parable doesn't tell us what the older brother did. Did he go in to the party and join the celebration? Or did he just stay outside and sulk? We're left not knowing. And through this parable, Jesus is saying to the Pharisees and others that are listening that all are welcomed into the celebration. That heaven celebrates when those who are lost are found. And so the question is, what do the Pharisees do? Do they choose to celebrate, or do they just choose to stay on the outside and grumble? And for us as a church, this question forces, this parable forces the question on us. Who are we in the parable? Are we the younger son, welcome into the loving embrace of the father? Or do we choose to be the older brother, resentful that others are drinking from our well? Would we rather stay on the outside as we pout about those undeserving folk getting Christ's attention? Or do we choose to celebrate that which was lost is found? And more importantly, do we trust that God will act like the father in the parable and look for us on the occasion that we become lost? And will that God bring us to him? Do we trust that God loves us all? So I encourage you to slam the door on this open-ended parable and choose to go into the party and choose to celebrate at the good fortune of all of our sisters and brothers who come to God, who know the love of the Father. And if we ourselves are not lost, let us celebrate that we are always with the Father, and the Father is with us. Finally, I'd like to close with a few words about stewardship, because during this month of October, I've been preaching these sermons on God's expansive love, God's willingness to seek out the lost. We've also been hearing from representatives from various committees of the church telling us about the activities and missions of our church so that you will understand more of what the church is doing. And the purpose of all of this is to encourage you to think and pray about your financial gifts to God through the church. And so in the month of October, we're asking you to prayerfully consider what you will give to God through the church in the coming year. And as I've been thinking about it all month, it strikes me that this is really an odd thing to do. It's a very quaint practice that we have, that I send a letter to you with a printed card and ask that you return this card to the church on a certain date. And on that card is your pledge for the coming year. I mean, the whole process is really very cumbersome. It's very inefficient. I mean, there are much easier ways we could do this. I mean, today we've got Venmo and online giving. You can schedule bank drafts or bank checks, so you don't even have to remember your contribution. It just happens automatically. Automagically even, you know. Giving is far easier than it's ever been. I know out in the world, I use my credit card to pay for things. Just tap and go. It's amazing. Some of you pay with your phone. Some of you pay with your watches even. I've encountered young people who refuse to carry cash with them. It makes them nervous, apparently. They just like to Venmo each other. I remember an old friend of mine, an older man. He was just the opposite. He wasn't wealthy, but he always carried with him about $2,000 in bills folded up and tucked in his back pocket where he sat. He called it his cushion. He was a child of the Depression, and he wasn't ever going to be caught without cash. Our stewardship practices are kind of like my friend, a little old-fashioned, a little out of date. But there's something to be gained from that. Our paying today has become so frictionless that sometimes we forget that we're doing it. It's too easy, isn't it? Stewardship invites us to slow down. Stewardship invites us to connect with God. Without friction, sometimes we get going so fast that we just zip right past God, wave our credit card, and go. But it's good to take a moment, to take a breath, to open an envelope, read a letter, look at a card, and think, what is my commitment to God going to be in the coming year? Stewardship forces us to be intentional in our giving. Stewardship also is a demonstration of our trust in God. Do we truly trust God with our souls, with our lives, with our money? Do we trust that God really will be there for us when we need God? Our planned giving is a display of our trust. Yes, you can give every week regularly, but commit to a year, and you are showing that you trust in God. So in a few minutes, I'll invite you to place your pledge cards in the offering plate. And as you do, I want you to make a little silent prayer, a prayer of thanks to God for the opportunity to give. And then after the offerings are brought forward, I'm going to offer a prayer of dedication. And if you haven't brought your pledge card with you today, that's fine. We've got some extras in the window over here. You can bring them to the office anytime. Or just call or email in with your pledge amount. We'll make it easy. So now, we are finished with Jesus' parables of the lost. The lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost brothers. So I pray now, my prayer for all of us is that we trust in God in those moments when we're lost, but that also, that we trust in God when we are with God. And if we're lost, we trust that God will seek us out until we're found. Amen.